3, 2, 1.
Here we go!
Welcome to the No Normal Show, brought to you by BPD, a marketing services firm that delivers the future to healthcare's leading brands. This show is where we leave all things status quo, traditional, old school, and boring in the dust, and instead we celebrate the new, the powerful, the innovative, the bold, all focused around the future of healthcare marketing and communications. I'm Stephanie Weirwill, EVP of Strategy and Innovation, and I'm joined by Drew Marlatt, VP of Data Products and Technology. Hi, Drew. Welcome.
Hey, Stephanie. So happy to be here. Thanks for having me on the show.
I am so excited to have you on, Drew. This has been kind of a dream of the show, really, because you are all knowledgeable about all things data, tech, and AI. And we've been talking a lot about AI and innovation on the show recently. And you've really spent the last year or so building BPD's own suite of AI workflows, AI agents. You come to us from a wide wealth of tech experience, including Shopify. So I can't wait for you to share all of your thoughts with our listeners.
Awesome. Yeah, it's going to be fun. Like you said, I've been hiding in the back rooms for way too long, right?
With the robots, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
All righty. So we have a fun agenda today. We are going to cover a few headlines. First of all, we've got a nice little pop culture headline about a song that just came out from T-Boz from TLC to raise awareness for HIV prevention. So I can't wait to talk about that. We're also going to talk a little bit about some new AI guidelines that came out in the medical space. And then our main topic today is a really fun one, which is how can healthcare organizations innovate with AI and what are the challenges they face and how can they really leapfrog over some of those challenges? So before we get into it, just a couple quick notes. In a couple weeks, we are partnering with eHealthcare on this topic, actually, AI and Healthcare Marketing Week. We're going to have a full week of virtual programming for marketing and digital leaders, intentionally focused around hospitals, health systems, and provider organizations. And so we'll drop a link in the show notes. Please sign up for that. It's 5 full days of sessions. I think there's like 10 plus sessions. And it's going to be a great time. And Drew, you're going to be on two of those sessions talking about AI agents and workflows.
That's right. Yeah. Once as a participant, once as a moderator. I'm super looking forward to it.
Me too. I can't wait to see all the case studies and hear all the discussions.
Oh, for sure.
And then also we'll drop a link to our latest report, which is called Crossing the Einstein Divide. We talked about this quite a bit on our show, and I think today's topic is related to it. We're not going to go into depth on the paper at all, but just kind of a relevant topic around innovating with AI. So we'll drop that in the show note as well. But before we get into it, Drew, since this is your first time on the show, would love to learn more about you. And maybe, we're coming right off of Thanksgiving weekend. So I'm really curious. What are some of your favorite Thanksgiving traditions, dishes? What's the vibe for you?
Oh, for sure. Thanksgiving is by far my favorite holiday. I don't know what it is. I mean, Christmas is great too, but I feel like Thanksgiving has the personal connection that Christmas doesn't necessarily lack, but maybe gets overshadowed by other elements of tradition and commercialism, et cetera, right? So I feel like Thanksgiving being all about gratitude and family and most importantly, food, really connects to my core interests, you know? I'm an avid home cook. I obsess about making the turkey. So I'm so glad to have just been able to smoke a turkey for my family. I live in the Midwest now, but I go full Southern when it comes to Thanksgiving. So smoked turkey, cranberry barbecue sauce, and cornbread stuffing are the must-haves for sure.
Cranberry barbecue sauce is something I need to try. That sounds amazing.
Oh, it's awesome. Very tangy. Yeah.
It's got all the things, the sugar, the vinegar, the fruit. That's brilliant. I've never heard of that. That's a first. And it's, to me, sauce is something amazing. So
yeah, I feel like cranberry sauce gets overlooked. A lot of times people just leave it out of the Ocean Spray can and it still is in the can shaped mold, you know?
Yeah.
How about you? Well, what's your favorite part about it?
Oops, sorry. I love a carb holiday. I love a carb in general. So for me, it's the dressing, it's the mashed potatoes, all of that. But yeah, I think I'm with you that Thanksgiving is the best holiday. And I'm going to try to start a trend next year of Thanksgiving decorations, like blow up inflatable turkeys in the front yard. I think Halloween decorations have gotten wild. Christmas decorations have, of course, been wild. We need a blow up turkey in our lives. That's my take.
For sure. Yeah. Give Thanksgiving its space. Give it its due. Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Well, good to catch up with you a little bit. So let's hop into our headlines. We found this headline. Actually, Tierra, who was on the show last week, shared this headline right after she was on the show. And I think it's just such a cool example of healthcare showing up in pop culture. So anybody remember, Drew, do you remember TLC and the song Creep from 1994?
Oh, yes. I think you and I are of a similar age, so this is right in my sweet spot.
It's a great nostalgic moment. So Creep was one of TLC's bigger songs. And so T-Boz from TLC teamed up with Gilead Sciences, which is a pharma company. However, they are going to market as Care for the Culture. So kind of like where the brand is kind of hidden. You have to dig to see who created Care for the Culture. It's Gilead Sciences, which is the pharma company that is known for the HIV prevention drug PrEP. And so T-Boz teamed up with them to create a song, a remake of Creep that raises awareness for HIV prevention. So instead of the original lyrics, which was So We Creep, it's now So We Prep, and kind of a great awareness song. I personally love this because, to your point, Drew, I am a millennial. I love a throwback. I want to live in the 1990s. And, you know, I think it's always an interesting play to say, how can we make something like health awareness memorable? And lyrics are a good way to do it. So
For
that's just my
sure.
take. What was your thought on this?
I completely agree. I think it's so nice, and we see this all the time, but it's so nice to see health systems find innovative ways to push preventative care specifically. You know, it's such an important part of making sure that the entire health system and our whole population is more healthy, more productive, better quality of life, all the things, right? So like to see that done here, and you know, HIV treatment and prevention is such a huge win for the pharma industry in the last few decades, that I mean, it's a great highlight for sure.
Yeah, and you know, you mentioned health systems, and I think we have several health system examples that we've talked about on the show that lean into culture. I mean, one example we talked about a few weeks ago was Baptist Health and Zotime. So that was a great example of maybe a celebrity forward partnership. Another quick headline. So we found this past week this AI code of conduct that was released for health and medicine. This was released by the National Academy of Medicine, and they created an AI code of conduct, and it gives six foundational commitments on everything from ethics and health equity and effective and responsible use of AI. So, what I think is really interesting about this is it includes a collaboration of authors such as a Permanente, Vanderbilt, Mayo Clinic, Memorial Sloan Kettering, Johns Hopkins, all the biggest names in healthcare, and they all collaborated to say, hey, AI is moving really fast. There aren't enough guidelines and guardrails for responsible AI use. And so this is a very long paper. We're not going to spend a lot of time on it. But for anybody who wants to dig into the weeds of it, we'll link out. And I think that, you know, the point here is just as the tech continues to race ahead, it's really important for folks to collaborate and think about the larger, more overarching guidelines. That's critical so that healthcare can leverage technology in the right ways. Drew, what did you think about the code of conduct?
I think it's a really great way to address the core issue right now, which is that a responsible AI is, first of all, a great passion of mine. I bill myself as a responsible AI evangelist, right? I think this is something we can and should be doing in a very thoughtful way. And we're in a space where I would argue responsible AI is still much more of a definitional problem than a technical one. Like, we have to be very careful and thoughtful about how we say, it's easy to say we want to be just and fair and transparent, but then we have to say, you know, what is justice? What is fairness? Who are being fair toward? What are we being transparent with? And all the things, right? So, this is a really good framework for being comprehensive, I think, not only on the research side, but on the clinician side too. They cover a pretty wide variety of use cases, so it's definitely worth a read. For me, like, there's four big categories that, at a minimum, any good AI policy should touch on, especially in healthcare. Data privacy should be number one always, both from a regulatory and a responsibility perspective. It's just ethically the right thing to do to protect our patients' data. The veracity of AI's outputs as well. So, is it allowed to lie to you? It shouldn't be. So, you should control for when and how you check for that. Is it exhibiting toxic behavior, or is it putting something out there in the world or into your patient population or your clinical population that you don't want to see in that like influenced in that way? And is it complying with intellectual property, both internal to your organization, protecting your IP, and also not violating others' IP? And that's still an open question about where those boundaries are, what's considered fair use, what isn't. Luckily, it's less on the it's less of an issue on the like provider side, on the company side of things. The folks building AI-enabled apps or building AI-enabled workflows, we worry about IP compliance a little bit less than folks who are building the next foundation model at Anthropic or something.
That was a great overview, and we could probably spend all day digging into all the things that you just mentioned, but it is so critical. But more importantly, it's really hard. It's really hard
Yeah,
to, you
it
know,
is.
this conversation requires philosophical conversations. It requires debate. It requires technical knowledge and understanding. It requires cross disciplines, you know, especially in healthcare, in the room, clinicians, you know, I know there's a lot of discussion around the importance of peer-reviewed science and bringing that forward. So I think you just unpacked it in a really beautiful, simple way. And I'm just adding like this. If it's not something that, you know, marketers and communicators are involved discussing right now organizationally, I think that is an important goal for 2026 is join the conversation in your organization about responsible AI use.
So glad you said that, because it's definitely one of those topics that's not a not somebody else, it's not my problem kind of vibe. That doesn't work here. Like, it to do this well, companies need to foster the right culture, and they need to bring everybody in at some point in the process, or at least embed the mindset for everybody in their workflows.
Yes. So maybe that's a good transition to our main topic, because what we're going to talk about here in the main topic of the day is what are the challenges that healthcare organizations face when they're thinking about innovating with AI? There are many challenges. Responsible AI use is one of them, a huge one, but there are others as well. They're cultural, they're people challenges, they're tech challenges, they're budget challenges, it's all the things. So we're always coming at this from kind of a marketing lens. However, more and more, what we're realizing is, you know, marketing is the purview is expanding. Marketing is getting more into things like patient communications, patient experience. Marketing has a right to bring forward the importance of leaning into AI organizationally in terms of how are we communicating this internally and externally, but also, you know, what are we doing operationally to make that patient and employee experience more meaningful? So, big, you know, ball of wax here. But why don't I just start at the beginning, which is it's the end of 2025. I think we at BPD have been kind of raising this flag really loudly that, hey, marketing is rebuilt from the ground up for all the reasons I just mentioned. Every single marketer, every single business leader has to rethink what they do. And so when we think about rethinking it, that's kind of where the paper I mentioned earlier comes into play. We kind of think about it in two parts. One is, how are you moving faster? That's critical. We call that Edison thinking. You know, how are you incrementally improving? How are you building a better light bulb? That's really important. It's the work that most marketers are thinking about right now. What folks are not talking about as much is what we call the Einstein approach, which is, you know, how are you reimagining the universe? And so that requires some big, crazy dreaming. And when you think about innovation, both in terms of marketing communications and organizational innovation, you have to have both approaches. So I'll just pause here and ask you, Drew. You know, I know this is a core part of your role, your job, and you think about this every day, both for BPD and for health systems. Are there any kind of things you would add just sort of to the overall landscape of why this is happening before we dig in?
No, I think that was such a great summary. You know, it's a shifting sands mentality right now. Things are moving so fast. It's been a tool that has democratized so much capability that wasn't there before, that was locked behind walls. So people are eager to take advantage of it. And you're totally right. I don't think it's an either or. I think it's a yes both. You know, you need to have strategies that go from the bottom up and from the top down.
Yeah, and we've done a lot of dreaming on this podcast. So anybody who's a longtime listener knows we have, you know, kind of gotten sometimes in the clouds around like, what if this could be possible? But I think what's interesting, and maybe it's timely since we just had Black Friday, but you know, probably over a year ago, we talked about agents shopping on our behalf, agents, you know, being able to crawl the web and not just know like, what do I want to buy, but actually buy it for me. And that's happening, right? ChatGPT has shot their shopping shopping features, their shopping research features, the Atlas, the, you know, kind of agent mode, all of that's happening. So I think as we sit here today, Drew, I'm very curious if you were to, I don't know, I like to predict, if you were to predict at the end of next year, are there things that you think that we're kind of dreaming about right now that might be a reality with the tech next year?
Oh, yeah, that's such a good point. I mean, the agentic AI, especially for shopping, I love this idea for like even my grocery shopping, by the way. Like, I would love to just feed it the links for the 5 or 6 recipes I want to make in a week, and it just goes and puts in an order to my local supermarket and I just pick it up. That would be great. But that's possible today. For next year, I think that the agentic usage, especially in the browser, it's going to upend a lot of, first of all, IT infrastructure that we've relied on in the past. I would argue the last decade, there have been a lot of focus projects on robotic process automation, RPA. So like, how do we automate things inside of browsers? And it's a very complicated and brittle process. I think this is going to completely eradicate that as a technology, when you can just tell your favorite AI tool, okay, log into this system for me, go fill out this web form, go grab this information, go scrape these articles, whatever the case may be. It may even eventually start getting rid of things like APIs and SDKs, when you can just have an AI agent go crawl through the website itself and just use the front end as if it was a user. Specifically to the clinician space, I've heard a few friends in this area talk about the rise of the need for AI doctors even. So right now, there's a lot of folks experimenting in the clinician space with things like automatically taking recordings of minutes or transcribing meeting notes when you're talking to a clinician. I mean, we've all been in a doctor's office, right, and seen them typing away while they're half listening to us. And they're very, very good at that. But if you take that away from them, let the machine do the transcription, the writing the prescriptions, the aftercare summaries, the treatment plans, all of that, and let the clinician just focus on having the conversation. That's the low-hanging fruit that people are trying to tackle right now in a lot of big and small companies. But as we've seen, like, what does that happen when, you know, you add a new vector to the treatment? Right now, you know, you might have an issue, you might go to a primary care doctor for a certain class of issues. Maybe you do a virtual appointment, maybe you go to urgent care or the ER. What does that fourth one look like where you just ask an AI doctor instead? And I think that this is a weird case where the users are way further ahead than the health systems are. I think users have already been doing this in the last few months with ChatGPT and others. I think we could talk about how ChatGPT is actually trying to roll that back and curtail that behavior for liability reasons. But I think the users are there. I think a lot of people want this either out of necessity or out of convenience. What I wonder about is, when will the technology be reliable enough that both the providers and the payers are comfortable with the level of risk that this introduces? So it's really more of an organizational question than a technical one.
Yeah.
At that point.
Wow. You just unpacked almost a whole roadmap in a way. Let me summarize quickly and see if I heard you right, Drew, and then we can kind of unpack like how to get to this mindset. Get here is harder than it seems, and we can unpack the challenges and, you know, kind of like the ways of thinking. So tell me if this sounds right based on what you just said. It sounds like you said ambient listening is already here. That's happening. It's not just being piloted, but it's been scaled at a lot of health systems. So in the next year, we'll see that roll out probably at mass. We are already seeing people, consumers, patients using AI tools for healthcare research, but not yet. And we expect this will come, sort of that more agentic use of like booking appointments, filling out forms, like that will come. Mm-hmm. And then what you're saying that's kind of like the furthest from where we are is, how would you, I'm going to use the word build lightly, right? Because it may not be a direct build, but if you have ambient listening today, how do you leverage all of that data and those kinds of models to then allow provider-like communication, provider-like is important verbiage there, provider-like communication with patients when the provider is not there, i.e. AI doctor. That, my take is we might see pilots of that next year, but probably wouldn't actually see in full until 2027. Tell me if you feel like that's a decent summary of your roadmap of sorts.
Spot on. Yeah. And I totally agree with that 5 check at the end on timeline. I think it's something where the health systems themselves will want to thoroughly de-risk it before they really let people do that. But imagine that AI doctor that already has and already has read your medical records, Of course, built inside of the ecosystem of whatever your EHR platform is, right? Or at least interfacing with it. But the responsibly built tool that can see what you're talking about, take those notes from whatever conversation you're having with it, update the medical records accordingly, pass those on to specialists, right? So I'm thinking about like, let's say I am playing soccer and I hurt my knee and I know like, okay, I'm going to go to the primary care. I'm going to talk to him about it for 20 minutes, and he's going to say, "Here is your referral to orthopedics." Maybe the AI doctor is the circumvention of that, where they can just give me the referral to orthopedics, right, without the intermediary step. It'll be interesting
Yeah.
to see where the dice lay on this one, you know?
It is. And yes, and the dice, it'll be interesting to see where the dice fall in terms of both physicians, how physicians feel about it, which right now early signals show there's a lot of appetite for it because physicians are overburdened and there's not enough of them. It'll be interesting to see where it falls in terms of consumer perception, all of that. So we have a long road to go to get to what you just talked about. So why don't we now, let's talk about what are all the challenges in place for that kind of thing. It may not play out like we just said, right? Those are examples, those are dreams, those are thoughts. There's a lot, there's a many, a million barriers. So let's talk about the barriers.
So true.
I'll throw a few out and then you can build. I'll just throw out a few here, which is in healthcare, we don't have the capital for all the pilots and pilot programs that, an OpenAI may have or even a retailer may have. And speaking of that, ex having an experimental mindset is key, and budget and experiments go hand in hand. So we know the importance of pilots and pilot programs. I'll tie back around to that because I know you have a lot of thoughts there as you've been somebody who's been doing a lot of those types of experiments, if you will. Healthcare is an operations industry. It should be, right? We cannot tear it down to the studs and rebuild it, nor should we ever do that. That is not something that especially health system leaders can even think about. So that's why we end up with more incremental innovation. It's like, what can we add? What can we edit versus how might we completely rethink, which is usually, the mindset we're thinking about here. And then we're risk averse, which again, we should be. None of these, I'm not calling these out to say these are bad. I'm calling these out to say these are truths. So as we consider, how do we get from here to there? These are constraints that we have to be mindful of. Let me just pause here. Drew, anything you want to talk about, especially in regards to the experimentation mindset and what that looks like in maybe your past life at a company like, let's say, Shopify or, an Amazon, and what that looks like in a healthcare setting.
Absolutely. I would love to. You're totally right. Healthcare is unique in that it's like it's half infrastructure and half deeply personal, right? So like it is foundational to us as a society, and it's also so critical to the individual. So like the risk is just so much higher when you have either a research or a clinical use case versus what we do with marketing, right? Not to belittle what we do, but no one's life is on the line. There are PR disasters that could happen, but like that's about the worst of it, right? So we definitely have more room to fail than a lot of other domains. But with experimentation, so there was a recent report from MIT that did a study. They found that the big headline, it's probably I think late August, early September, the big headline was 95% of AI projects and pilot projects specifically fail. And a lot that picked up a lot of noise. And the byline that a lot of people ran with was AI is not working out the way we thought it was. And I think they're missing the point. My take on it is that 95% of AI projects are failing because they're meant to fail. And there's a lot of reasons for that. This is an area of rapid innovation. There is a lot of small players. There are a lot of companies trying to do everything all at once for a lot of reasons. Part of it is, let's be real, senior leaders at company, executives, they are people too, and they are prone to FOMO as everyone else is, right? So like they're afraid of waiting for the dust to settle and then being too late to the game to be a major player, right? So people are willing to take risks on things that are a little bit more cutting edge. A lot of it is an appeal to an investor group, right? So a lot of times people do want to see that you're using AI, so they're not afraid that their investment isn't going to play out. And then the third and most important thing is people really are just trying to like do what's best for their organization. And right now, it's worth it to take the moonshot bet sometimes, I suppose. There's a few really cool findings in that paper though that I'd love to call out. One of which was that they found that there is a big differentiation between where the idea originates. So pilot projects that start from the top are more likely to fail, but they're also more likely to be big thinking blue skies, Edison like, or excuse me, Einstein like projects that we're promoting. The projects that tend to succeed are the ones that start lower down the org chart. The people who do the actual hands-on work, when they emerge ideas for AI projects, they're really tactile. They're very small scale. They're more Edison-like projects that are trying to refine sticky workflows, and they are more likely to add value mostly in the form of cost avoidance, right?
Yeah. So you just beautifully shared one of the solutions, I think, which let me come back to that, which I think, you know, it's what you just talked about is how do you actually build an experimentation mindset? And it has to be top down and bottom up, right? Mm-hmm. If I heard your takeaway from what you just mentioned, in order to take this pilot and experimentation approach, you have to, number one, recognize that there will be some failures. You have to merchandise that so everybody is aware and they know what to expect. And then you have to create this kind of cultural rethink, which is a top-down encouragement for big and the bold and a bottom-up experimentation for moving faster and all of that. I'm just going to add to the MIT study point. One thought I had as you were talking about the MIT study around how, you know, AI pilots are meant to fail, which maybe the report didn't highlight that part. I think it was Jeff Bezos who was recently talking about, you know, are we in an AI bubble or not? And he gave a great analogy, which I really enjoyed, which was if you go way back to the railroad building times, that was a huge revolution of infrastructure. And one of the ways that it became successful was everybody got into the railroad game because there was so much money to be made and there was so much building that some of these tracks were literally side by side and duplicative. So there was waste in the revolution. And I think his point was there has to be waste. You can't revolutionize, you know, a society, industries, business without having some waste along the way. Now we can stop and pause and go have a cocktails conversation about the, you know, ramifications of that, all of that. But I think just to, you know, think about this from a organizational standpoint, it is for healthcare who doesn't have the capital to make a major pilot programs. It is what can you do that's really small? So some examples are, to your point of bottom up, right? A marketing team, I think, is in a great position to have a top down, bottom up approach. Top down, hey, let's have an overarching vision for our department around what we want to do. Bottom up, everybody go experiment and come up with, you know, very small experiments that actually are not costly at all. Just how can you automate your workflows using the tools you have? What is one business problem that maybe you can find that's relatively small that you can come up with a 90-day pilot that we can go test? None of those have to be costly. In marketing, back to your previous point, we're not talking here about clinical applications of AI. We need to know those. But, you know, we don't actually have to be creating those on our side. If culture needs to be changed from the top and the bottom, right? Top down vision from leadership, CMO, CSO, and beyond, bottom up approach from all the team members across the department. Let's talk a little bit about how you do that. Because I think this is the, to me, in all of our conversations we've had with healthcare organizations about their AI approaches and their AI initiatives, especially in marketing communications, I think the thing that I learned over and over again, it might sound obvious, but it's actually very hard and it's a lot to unpack, is at the end of the day, it's much more about changing your culture than it is about understanding the tech. Yes, you need AI literacy. Yes, you need education across every single team and team member. Yes, you need the right tech and tools in place, and you got to have a strong partnership with legal and IT. That is this first step, but the much longer battle is changing culture. Yes. So let me just ask you, Drew, you know, have you seen anything in your experience that you think is really impactful in terms of creating an experimentation mindset, encouraging that bottom-up grassroots experimentation approach, encouraging teams to dream, all of that?
Absolutely. I mean, you nailed it, right? Like, culture comes from the top always. And here the key culture is, how do you build thoughtful experiments in a way that are designed to succeed, right? So I loved your idea of the 90-day pilot. Really, the key there is it doesn't have to be 90 days. It could be 45, it could be 30, it could be 180, as long as you time box it. And you build something that has a measurability component to it. So where projects tend to fail is when they don't do a good job at the start of defining the scope or to figuring out, like, how do we measure success in this? And that can be a really hard thing to do, right? Especially when you're dealing with a pretty vague subject matter. So maybe it's something like patient experience scores or appointment availability or mean time for an appointment or something like that. It could be a lot of things. It really depends on your use case. For us, for cost efficiency work, we tend to focus on things like how long does it take for a certain workflow to go. So, we've done some work on marketing strategy that we've been able to take a week-long workflow, skin it down to just like less than an hour, and that was a very long, complicated process to get there. But, it took like you said, probably about 90 days, and we knew what our goal was from the very start. So as long as you're willing to do that, you can take some risks more effectively. I think the old school stat I heard was that the two most likely ways that project will fail in general, even outside of AI projects, is scope creep or resource starvation. So resource starvation is less of an issue here because these things are so well democratized. It's very easy for you or I to go into ChatGPT or something and like build a pretty small proof of concept just to show, hey, this is possible. We just need to find the right data, the right context, wire it together with the right technology. But for the scope creep thing, that's where these things really do struggle, because you define we wanted to do ABC, and then you go present it to a stakeholder after 45 days, and they say, that's nice, but what about DEF, right? Why isn't it doing that yet? So you need to be very clear with your stakeholders what you're trying to accomplish, how good is good enough. And I used to always hear from like professors in grad school, keep it sophisticatedly simple. Like the goal is parsimony. You want to find the simplest solution that accomplishes your goals and make it no more complicated than that. Because as you add more complications, you add more risk.
Yeah. So I think one of the things you said in there that I think is, there's a million great takeaways from what you just said, but I think one of them that sticks out to me is, you mentioned like some of the examples that BPD has, that you've been building in partnership with your team here at BPD. I think those are really analogous to health system, pilots that might happen in Marcom teams. So for us, the benefit to our clients and customers is they need projects yesterday. They, the world is moving fast. They need work that's really fast. And they need it that's high quality. They need it with high expertise. And so kind of our principle is, how do we start on third base, if you will? How do we start having all the data at our fingertips and then leverage our human expertise and talent in order to get the client what they need immediately? Your point about hours or days, not weeks, is a major, customer or client benefit. Now, take that same mindset and put it inside a marketer's mindset at a health system. I think starting with the problem you're trying to solve, I know it's a duh, but it's like rarely done. So we just ran a workshop at HCIC to help health system marketers create their own pilot projects. So what we did was we started with a discussion in the room about what are the business problems you need to solve. And sometimes they have their own clients. Their own clients are service line leaders, physicians. Sometimes it might be an internal problem you need to solve. And sometimes it might be a patient problem you need to solve. And sometimes it might be a business problem you need to solve. So we had a really good, robust discussion in the room at HCIC about what are those business problems that are small enough, but impactful enough to solve. And then we went from that all the way to what's a 90-day pilot. And it was so cool to see people's wheels turning and to see, them working with their chatbot to figure this out. And what's exciting is, 2025 has been a year for so many health system marketing teams to be experimenting and piloting inside their own functions. And I hope that 26 is about scaling those. We love having those convos.
Yeah, I love that. That's such a great call out that like the 90-day pilot isn't about profitability. The 90-day pilot's about proving what's possible, So like you have success there, and then the success in that is learning that it is feasible enough that it will be profitable at scale. And then you can take the next steps to make it scalable, productionizable. In healthcare marketing specifically, we see this all the time, where 90 days isn't enough time to see an effect on patient populations at all. We're talking about scales more unlikely in like 18 months or more, So you start small, you design an experiment, maybe it's a simple A/B test or something more complicated, and you figure out, hey, is this going to work at all? And if you see the signal, you go for it, invest in it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's wrap on that call to action. I love that. Which is how do we one, experiment and pilot. Number two, how do we scale? And number three, how do we make sure we're thinking long term? So thank you for joining, Drew. This was a blast. You and I could go on forever. I just love hearing what you have to say and pulling from your expertise.
Likewise, Stephanie, this has been great. And I hope it's the first of many.
That's right. All right. So for everyone listening, let us know of, you know, your pilots. What are you experimenting with? What are you excited for 2026? Drop us a note if you would like. And until next time, don't be satisfied with the normal. Don't be satisfied with your run-of-the-mill pilot. Really push it. Push it to scale. Push your culture and push the no normal. And we'll talk to you soon.
3, 2, 1. Here we go.